Hey guys, welcome to another episode of Can You Edit That Out? This is another old episode that I had recorded with James Schrader probably around March or April. And I just found it recently and I'm very excited about it. This is an episode with Dallas McLaughlin. Dallas is somebody that I'd seen do stand-up before I started, when I was going to the comedy shows regularly at Lestat's. Saw him there and thought he was great. And then we started when I started comedy, had him on a couple of my shows, and he's always been so fun to watch. I'm really a big fan of his. And he's also a very, very talented person. He was a writer for Yo Gabba Gabba, Aquabat Super Show. And he's just done so much stuff. I'm really, really impressed by how much talent he has. And I was happy to get to learn so much about him doing this interview. And for this episode, we went over to his house and his daughter was there. So you could probably hear her crying. We mentioned this a couple of times. You could hear her crying throughout the episode. And at some point, I'm holding her while he's doing the interviews to kind of give him a break so he could focus on the podcast. So there's a little bit of that, some interruption from the baby, but she was really great as well and very well behaved. And so it didn't cause too much issues with the interview. So hopefully a little bit of baby crying in the background doesn't bother you too much. And thanks, guys. I hope you enjoyed the episode.
You want to do it? It's the worst.
She just did her first musical the other day.
All right, guys, this is going to be another episode of Can You Edit That Out? My name is David Zaffer, and I'm here with my co-host,
James Schrader. Hey, everybody. Up,
our guest today is Dallas McLaughlin.
Hi, guys.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Fantastic.
It's episode 6?
5?
We 5? Don't know.
You don't know yet?
I don't even know at this point anymore.
I'm just trying to get these out.
That's all we want.
We both are also want to release them eventually.
Okay, well, let's do it, guys. Today is the day.
All right,
you send me the file. I'll send it to iTunes. I'll just email podcast@itunes.com.
Okay.
Which might be a thing.
Probably. That's probably the fastest way to get it up. Nobody knows.
Yeah. Dang it, we might have just discovered something. I'm holding my baby.
Yes, the baby is here.
So if she starts making noise, I'm sorry. We'll have to pause. But it'll right now, okay. She's doing
you
all
hear
right.
Somebody throwing up, it's
me or the baby. I drink a lot.
So Dallas is
yes,
a stand-up comic.
Sometimes.
And sometimes a writer. Sometimes.
Let's use your words. What are you, Dallas? What do you do?
I am unemployed. Just kidding. I'm a humorist.
Mm-hmm.
I think of myself as a
things of humor.
I like to. If I could, I'd be a cartoon strip panelist. Isn't that what they're called?
Cartoonist.
Cartoonist, but they only do the strips.
Drawing or the
like Gary Larson, the Far Side.
Okay.
I do that.
Do you?
That's what I call myself. When people
you
ask.
Call yourself Gary Larson.
I call myself Gary Larson. Yeah, creator of the Far Side. Yeah.
Nice.
I'm Gary Larson, the rap band, not the. sorry. I don't know what I would call myself. I guess
you meddle in everything.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, artist sounds so pretentious, and I don't know if what I do is really art, but I guess humorist would be the closest thing to what I attempt to get paid for.
Is okay. That, yeah, that's more what you're
so
trying to do.
So it kind of encompasses
for?
Everything that I do, because I write comedy, perform comedy, and, you know, sometimes I write plays and musicals, and then I act and stuff like that, so...
That are comedic themselves as well?
Most of the time they're comedic, but I enjoy, when I write for the stage, I enjoy doing like dark humor, like really dark mm-hmm. things, like things that don't always end well.
Can that be funny sometimes?
Well, dark comedy I think is funny. I think
yeah,
it's very funny. Like,
I like it.
Movies like The Cable Guy or a movie called, what's that Vince Vaughn movie? The Breakup.
Yeah,
is like a dark, mm-hmm. dark comedy. It just there's a lot of gnarly things that happen, and it doesn't end well. Like I like doing stuff like that. I like movies where the guy doesn't get the girl.
Does that kind of reflect a little bit of your outlook on life? This kind of
yeah, I would love to leave my wife, but I can't.
Not now.
Can't do it. Not
now. Quite, not quite what I meant.
Dumb baby.
You kind of have, because I kind of have an attraction to that kind of thing also. I like
leaving
good,
your wife?
No. Okay. I like things that are funny, but also really like dark. Like, I love the ending of Annie Hall because of the same thing.
They
end up together, and there's just something, like, it's reassuring about making things that are serious and bad funny. I don't, but is that a kind of philosophy that you've lived with? Like, you're kind of existentialist, maybe?
Whoa. Don't know. Don't throw those words around. I don't know. I mean, I like things that are more interesting than just, like, fluffy.
Yeah.
Although, don't get me wrong, like, I enjoy... I mean, I peed my pants when I saw Ace Ventura in the movie theater. I was like 12 at the time, but still, you know. So, I mean, I love that stuff too, but I'm more interested in, and just things that make you think a little bit more and are maybe more into the aspect of humanity.
They're actually touching you as a human, not just like tickling your funny bone.
They're complete movies, I think. Right. Like, I think like a great example of a movie that it was almost there was Funny People.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was two movies made into one. And either one could have worked, and either one had so much humanity in it, but they screwed it up. Like Garden State, another great example. If he just leaves and gets on the plane at the end of that movie, it would probably be one of my top 25 movies.
But the fact that he comes back and gets on the escalator.
Back, yeah, ruined it. Stupid. He did another movie. Did you see his movie he did after that? I think it was called The Long Kiss Goodbye or The Last Goodbye.
Kiss.
Last Kiss?
Yeah.
Dude, that is a dark, crazy movie.
That was really good.
And ends the way... It should, and no one liked it. Like, it did terrible.
Well, I mean, it did kind of have a happy ending in a
way. It didn't.
Well, because she lets him back in the house.
Does she?
Yeah.
That's she does let him back in the house. She sleeps on the porch and
stuff.
Yeah, she
does, but it's kind of open-ended, so you don't know what's going to happen with the relationship.
See, I'd rather open-ended than my dad's calling me, guys.
We can pause.
Should we pause
put
it?
Him on the podcast. It's fine. No, hang up, smash him.
Yeah, we'll hang up on him. He's coming out to see. He doesn't live here. He lives in Ohio. Okay. So he's coming out to see his grandbaby.
Is that where you grew up?
Next week.
Yeah, let's start there. Where's Dallas from? How did you get here?
Well, I had a baby, and where did I come
where
from?
Where did you come from?
I was born in Ohio.
Okay.
But my parents split up when I was 3. My mom moved here because my grandfather was here, her dad, and my dad stayed in Ohio. So I grew up in Claremont here in San Diego. And my dad stayed out in Ohio. And that's where he's always been.
You go on summers or half the year?
Until I was 16, I was supposed to go out there every summer. Or we were supposed to just see each other every summer. So, but he never came out to San Diego, really, because he had a full-time job. And so we would go out there for summers, and it was the worst thing ever, except for that he had cable, and we could watch MTV, and that was awesome. So, like, I have a lot of fond memories of Soundgarden's videos. And, oh, there's some more spit up. Guys, my baby's spitting up. And you know, that's uncomfortable.
So, siblings? Did you have any siblings or only child? Where are you at?
I have a brother and a sister. They're both older.
So, you're the youngest?
Youngest.
Okay.
And by 4 years, I think my sister's 4 years older. I don't talk to my brother or sister, so I don't know what their deals are.
What's up with that?
Yeah, let's...
Guys, can we edit this out? Hey, we did
if
it!
If you really want to.
No.
When did that happen?
When were they born?
I don't know. To your...
My sister has had her issues in life. I think we've all probably have that cousin or sibling that goes through their own things.
Yeah.
And we choose to trust them or not trust them at a certain point in our lives. And for me, when I decided not to trust her, it also came with just kind of writing her off. And God, let's see, man, I was probably like 17 or 18. She stole my car. Oof. She stole my car and then she got impounded.
Yeah.
And then she came back with it. And I said, you stole my car for like a week. And she's like, well, it got impounded and I got it out of there. So you're welcome. Like, that was her reasoning. Was
Jesus.
I should be thanking her for getting it out of the tow truck or whatever the hell it is. And, so that was pretty much it. And then my brother and I talk every now and then. Not really a lot. He lives in Ohio with his family. He's got 4 kids. They're awesome kids. His wife's super, super nice. And he lucked out because he's a moron. He'd be fine with me saying that. Or not. I don't care. He was like 7 years older and such a jerk to me when we were younger. And I've just always held on to that.
Yeah.
So you guys were never close growing up?
Never close.
There was such a gap.
There was such a gap, and he was such a jerk.
Yeah.
And I just never got over it. Still haven't. So he came out here a couple of years ago with his family to visit. And the closest we get is like having burritos together, and then it's kind of done after that. Not really a lot to talk about. We don't have any of the same interests. He likes guns. Mm. I could care less. Except firing guns is very fun. and that's it. So we talk every now and then. We'll send emails or whatever. I don't know. It's weird. I don't know if you guys have siblings, but...
I do a lot.
Oh, you have a lot?
Well, he's Mexican.
One of six.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Not
Are you the like youngest?
No, I'm in the middle.
Really? Yeah. I always forget that you're not 19 years old. Like, I mean, right?
Well, he's only 23. He's only 4 years away from that.
You're only 23?
Mm-hmm.
You're already married with kids?
Well, I mean, they were twins. So it's not like, you know.
No, I'm not. Listen, if I could have done it a little earlier, I would have.
Would you?
Yes.
You would have go ahead and popped this one out 5 years ago?
Well, my wife and I met when, I was 29. I just turned 30 when we, like, officially became boyfriend and girlfriend. And, I would have done. Obviously, I had to wait to meet her, but if I could have made it happen a little earlier, I would have. Being a dad at 33 is tough business, man. It is. She keeps me on my toes, and I'm not in shape. So
that is one of the things that I like about having kids at this young age is that I have all this, especially two of them. I can, like, you know, I'll take them to the park, they'll run opposite directions, and I have the energy to run after one.
Yeah.
And it's always the one that's in most immediate danger that I have to go after first.
Yeah,
can be tough.
My wife is young. My wife is 24.
Okay.
Or, wait, 25. Whatever.
It's fine.
She's one of those. She's young. I went young. I go young.
Yeah, yeah.
Like 24. She's got to be 24. Doesn't matter.
We rewind it back.
She
a
won't listen
bit.
To this. She doesn't listen to my podcast. She won't listen to this. But yeah. Anyway, she has the energy to keep going, but I don't.
It seems really calm.
No, she's good. I told you because you guys are here. She's good.
Okay.
She's very interested in all this.
Listening to people talk.
But she'll get bored in a minute, and then all hell will break loose. Because what do you do to entertain a baby? You don't know. No idea.
Nothing.
Yeah.
See? They're just staring at the world, soaking it in.
Yeah.
Yep,
see, she's
there
about
it is.
Up. See, I told you. She's about to get uncomfortable. James said it'd be better with a baby. I told him he was wrong.
I said it'd be interesting.
It will be interesting for all the people that stopped listening already. How many times are they going to stop?
It'll be fine.
So you got two siblings.
Two siblings.
You hardly talk to
them. Don't talk to them.
Grew up out here. Dad's back in Ohio.
Back in Ohio. Still there.
When were you funny? When did that start?
What a weird question. I don't even know if I am funny. I don't know. I just started performing when I was 12.
When did the compulsion to want to entertain people start?
Yeah.
I grew up in a Catholic home.
Okay.
So an Irish Catholic home. So, I mean, you could put the pieces together there. A lot of people weren't happy all the time.
Yeah.
And since I was the youngest kid, it was like, well, I'll make everyone happy. I'll be silly and stupid. Mm-hmm. And it never really worked. But it made me feel better. And so, So, I mean, that's kind of when I started to really, like, want to, like, make people laugh and be stupid and stuff. And that turned into, like, being on stage and being an actor and doing theater and, I was in my first play when I was 12, and it was a musical at my church, Christmas musical.
Huh? Were your parents proud?
My mom was very proud. My mom always wanted to be an actress. She was an actress for a while in college, and she always wanted to continue acting and stuff, but she just never really got the chance. So she was very, very happy that I got the chance to go into it and stuff, and early, and she really wanted me to, like, continue doing it and stuff. And so I did. So I did that, and then I started working with a group called Christian Youth Theater here in San Diego and started doing musicals. And when I was, I had a basketball scholarship to Horizon at the time, Horizon Christian Junior Senior High, but I don't know, I think they're called Horizon Christian Academy now. That's my baby, if you can hear it. She's like, shut up. I had a basketball scholarship. I played basketball for a while, and then in my ninth grade, I blew out my knee skateboarding. And, they took my scholarship away, and so I transferred to SCPA, San Diego School of Creative Performing Arts. And I just kept doing theater. So then I made theater like the prime thing I did.
When you started going down this path and your mom realized that maybe you weren't trying to do the typical route, did she start telling you to kind of like get things together and maybe get like a, you know, go do the whole school, job, family kind of thing?
No. My mom didn't care at all. My mom, you know, we had to pay to do the musical theater and stuff and not take the extracurricular classes. She worked two jobs. I mean, it is like one of those classic stories of my mom just believed in what I was doing, and she totally was on board, and she totally supported everything. And so, like, you know, she never pressured me to get a job. She never pressured me to do anything other than just be in shows and work hard and at what I was doing. And she still does to this day, which is odd. She just wants me to get jobs in my field. She'd rather that happen than anything else.
So even the punk band, like, she was supportive. She's like, oh, you're musical. That's great. You're wonderful. Be a punk.
Yeah. She was very supportive of the punk band. But she came to our first show. We were so bad. And then, actually, my first band was called the Mutant Turtles. And we played at a place called Soul Kitchen in El Cajon. It isn't there anymore. And she came, and she thought it was stupid, and it was stupid. And then our drummer told her to F off.
Oh, Jesus.
And so I was never allowed to be in the band again.
Did your drummer know that that was your mom lady in the crowd? Or
no, our drummer not at the show. This was later. The drummer was one of my best friends. We hung out a lot, and he just told my mom to F off. And she was like, well, you're never hanging out with Kevin again. And I was like, oh, so when you're 15, like, your punk attitude goes as far as your mom lets it. she was right. Kevin was kind of a mess. But he went on to form, like, some really influential bands in San Diego. Uh-oh. He did well. He did, like, a band called the Beautiful Mutants, which a lot of people know of if you're in San Diego, and kind of formed this whole mutant punk scene that exists to this day. So, I mean, he's a good guy and, like, a really visionary musician, but just a jerk person. But he was a punk. I mean, he was really a punk, and I was just kind of, like, existing in a punk world.
From Christian theater, too.
And I wasn't a bad kid, so, I mean, that helps, like... I wasn't a bad kid. So that helps, like, with, like, getting away with stuff. Like, my mom never really worried about me because she knew that, like, I wasn't going to go do drugs. Like, I never had an interest in drugs. Still don't. And, like...
We do drink, though, right?
I drink alcohol, but I waited until I was 21 to drink.
Oh, wow.
And that didn't have anything to do with my Christian upbringing. It was just the fact that those were, I don't know. I just... You playing? James is saying hi. Be nice. Yeah, I mean, people like, oh, you smoke weed because you do comedy, right? And I'm like, ugh. Like, I hate that stigma. And I just never smoked weed. I had more interest in skateboarding, and I had more interest in, like, being funny, like, doing shows and being on stage. And at the time, it was all acting. I had no interest. When I was in high school, I didn't do comedy or anything. It was just...
You weren't writing anything. You were just... Give me
wasn't writing anything.
Page and I'll do it. I'll perform.
But I started to get the itch to write. Probably around when I was like 16, 17, my friends and I discovered Monty Python's Flying Circus. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of like the big trigger. And then we found Kids in the Hall. And everybody was watching Saturday Night Live, so like that doesn't,
right.
You know, mean it. I mean, everybody was watching it. And also around the same time, like we woke up to late night TV, like Letterman and Conan had just really became what Conan was. I guess it was around 94, 95. And so like all these great comedy things were like happening at once, and I was just falling in love with all of it. But I had a much bigger relationship with like sketch comedy than I did with anything stand-up wise. Although I loved Bill Cosby and Steve Martin, those are still to this day two of my heroes. But I just wasn't there wasn't any stand like Eddie Izzard's Dressed to Kill was one of the first specials I like sat down and watched, and it was like amazing to me.
Yeah,
so brilliant. And that was probably the first time I was like, maybe I could do this. I know that sounds weird watching a British transvestite. But it was the first time I like thought to myself, like, comedy's something I could try and do and stand up. And then 96 or 97 is when Mr. Show started. And that was like the thing that just finally got it going, like finally like made me want to start doing sketch comedy.
Now this is during punk music and other musical
I was in involved in music all the way until probably 2 years ago. I was in a band always until about 2 years ago.
Do you think that helps the creative process? Do you think
depending on the band.
Well, I mean, the outlet alone of being musical, of whether that's riffing and improvising with an instrument or just stage presence or comfort.
Well, see, I don't know how to play anything. I never played an instrument.
Just your face? You just play forever. Your mouth.
I was in punk band, so I can just scream. I mean, and I love punk music. Like, I love it. The first time I ever heard Black Flag, it was literally like, what is this? And then I heard Bad Religion, No Control, and that was it. I was like, this is what I'm listening to for until I die. Like, it just changed everything.
And at the same time, you were doing comedy? Writing sketch?
I hadn't written much sketch. Sorry, I know this timeline's really wacky.
That's fine.
Here, I'll try to make it better. I graduated high school.
Yep.
I was going to go to college, but then I realized that I hate school. So I started auditioning locally for shows and found out there's such a little clique locally with all the theaters. If it's not union, it's like, well, we use our people. So it was hard to get in anywhere to shows. I got cast in some shows here and there. I didn't have much fun. I hate auditioning. It's the worst. And so when I was 20, my girlfriend at the time said, why don't you just do your own thing? And so I rented a theater in Hillcrest. Got some buddies together that I grew up with that are still my friends that work in the industry. Most of them still work in the industry. We started writing sketches. We formed a sketch group, and we started putting on shows. We did shows every 3 months for 3 years. This was 2000 to 2003, and around 2002 is when I started playing. I played in punk bands all the way up until then, but nobody cared about any of those bands. And then I started a band in 2002 with my best friend, Matt Gorney, we started a band called Bad Credit. And then that was the band we were in until 2009, I think was the last time we played a show. And so during that time, we wrote sketch, we did the band. I still work at SeaWorld part-time, but I started working at SeaWorld in 1999 doing the Sea Lion and Otter show. So, like, going out in front of the crowd and doing the pre-show and performing in front of the crowd and, you know, being stupid, dancing around, messing with the audience, like, doing gags with the audience, pulling them up and doing stupid stuff. So, I was doing all of this at the same time.
And then... And then
somewhere in there, I started working in radio.
And then as well as, like, when was the Aquabats?
So, the Aquabats happened because Bad Credit, we played with the Aquabats at SOMA here in San Diego. And we just immediately, like, fell in love with each other. And because our job, Bad Credit, the point of Bad Credit was to start a band that was a punk band but played Run DMC and Beastie Boys music.
We punk wanted to be style. Like
the, huh?
Punk style.
Not punk style. Just the attitude of everything was punk. Like, we wanted to, like, if the audience was being jerks to us, then we were going to be jerks right back. Like, we came up in a bar. That's where we first started playing, was in a bar. It was just no holds barred. Let's jump, like, I mean, literally, like, the first, if we got on stage, the first thing we would try to do is get off the stage and into the crowd. I mean, we just tried to do as many things wrong as we could, and for some reason, it just caught on, and so, like, every time we tried to blow it up, like, we'd get something better, and so the Aquabats were kind of the same feel, where it was more about having fun. It wasn't like, we didn't want to, like, you know, G.G. Allen it, like, poo in our hands and throw it at people. It was, it was more like, let's just have a huge party. And if you're not having fun, we might force you to have fun. And the Aquabats were kind of the same thing. So we became really good friends immediately. And then they took us on the road, and they had a pilot already, or they had a show that was already picked up, but then on Fox Family, but then Fox Family got nixed, like the whole thing, or ABC Family, one of them, the whole channel got nixed. And so they had found out that we wrote sketch comedy and that we, at the time, we were doing Comedy Death Ray. We became friends with Scott Aukerman. We started doing Comedy Death Ray in L.A., doing sketches. And they found out we had that relationship and that we could write, and so they like hired us. They didn't pay us anything, but they said, let's sit around and start writing pilots. And then we wrote a bunch of different pilots, and out of those pilots came the idea for Yo Gabba Gabba.
So you were part of the think tank that came up with Yo Gabba Gabba.
We were part of the group that came up with it, and then we had an idea in place, and then they brought, like, we kind of, maybe like 6 months, we weren't hanging out with them, and there was a guy that they brought in, a buddy of theirs, who said, let's, like, revamp this and make it way more kid-friendly, because it was a kid show, but it was a little different format. It was more like Land of the Lost style. And then they said, let's make it way more like kid-friendly, almost like the Teletubbies, but mm-hmm. a badass, cool, we would watch this version of the Teletubbies. Yeah. And so when we came back, they approached us like 6 months later and said, will you help us write music? Because all the music is very hip-hop based.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started helping them write music. And then, yeah, we were a part of the process for, they did 4 seasons. We worked on 3 seasons and the pilot. And then during the time of Yo Gabba Gabba, we finally created a version of the Aquabats Super Show that got picked up. And also by the help of Yo Gabba Gabba's success, you know, people didn't want to be the guys that passed on the next Yo Gabba Gabba.
Right.
So Aquabats got picked up, and then we started working on that.
Now, is 4 seasons of Yo Gabba Gabba, that's success. It's 4 seasons. It's not 1 season.
Well,
what happened there?
Well, see, the kids shows are different. I mean, they run differently because if you watch Sesame Street today, you would see stuff from when we were kids edited in. So they'll re-edit episodes, and they'll they'll re-air episodes because their target audience is like 2 to 5.
So once they hit 5, just start over. We don't need 9 seasons.
Don't need them. They can just re-edit episodes. They can re-air episodes. There's always a new 2-year-old. And kids love repetition. They love seeing the same thing over and over again, hearing the same thing over and again. I mean, I'm sure you're getting to the phase where your kids probably want to hear the same song or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's just, so actually they had to, after the second season, they had to fight to do a 3rd season. And then had a fight to do a 4th season. And that was the end of it after the 4th season. They were like, we don't want to pay for this anymore.
Well, I'd like
all we need.
I'd like to thank you for that show, because when I was married and had stepdaughters, I watched a lot of Yo Gabba Gabba.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, this is quality programming that I can enjoy as
it's
well.
It's a great show. Gorney and I wrote a song.
We had really good music on there, too.
Our claim to fame was we wrote a song called Party in My Tummy.
Oh, okay.
Which was like the big hit.
Yeah.
But we got paid like $300 for that song. And I went to Target. After that show really took off, I went to Target and there was a kid's book called Party in My Tummy. And I was like, motherfucker.
You had no rights to, no nothing.
No rights, man. And like, you know, we were just working on it. And this was our first TV thing. And they weren't trying to like dick us over or anything like that.
No,
that wasn't the plan. It was literally like, no one knows how this is going to go. We don't have a budget. Like, the guys who created Yo Gabba are not anywhere near wealthy.
Yeah.
They had to sign the shittiest of deals to make that show land.
But now hopefully they have opportunities because of it. That's
well,
really
I mean, now they work, if they want, they work nonstop.
Yeah.
But it's never, they're still waiting. Like, Aquabats Super Show, we barely made any money off that. And the same guy, Christian Jacobs, who is the singer of the Aquabats, was one of the creators of Yo Gabba and created the Aquabats. You know, they basically make enough money to keep going, maybe buy a house, maybe.
I mean, that's buy a house or put a down payment on a house?
I don't know the specifics. But he has a house. But they also, they're Mormon, so they just keep having kids.
Oh.
But, yeah, so, I mean, they get chances to work and do stuff, and it's very fun, and I'm glad to be a part of their group. It's a very fun group to be a part of. I mean, you've seen Yo Gabba, you've seen the Aquabats. It's just silliness.
Definitely.
It's all silliness. So one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And somewhere in there, yeah, I was stand-up and started. And to your point earlier when you were saying, like, the music, does that help being on stage and stuff? The fact that I started stand-up when I was, God, when I was 29... I started doing stand-up when I was 29, and by that time, I'd done everything I could on stage. You know, at SeaWorld, you can perform in front of, you know, 5,000 people. In a bar, you know, you get called every name you can get called. You get, even if you're playing music, you get heckled, you get beer thrown at you, you get fights. So by the time I stood up to do jokes, I was like, this is stupid. Like, this is dumb. Like, this is the easiest thing I've ever done.
Yeah, I don't have to set anything up. I just walk up and do this.
The first time I ever did stand-up was at the Blarney Stone, which is where our band started. And Allison Gill, who I love dearly, was hosting the open mic at the time. And she said, why don't you and Matt Gorney come in and do some stand-up? Because we'd always talked about doing it. And we were like, sure. So we were like, well, the only way we're going to do it is if we write each other's joke. Like, we write jokes for each other. And we do characters. Because we came from sketch. So I did a Stephen Wright-esque character. And he did, like, a comic. We had this bit. We wrote a sketch that never happened, probably for the best. But it was the comic who went into a coma in 1991 and then just woke up and started doing stand-up that night. So all of the jokes were from, like, 1991. And his, like, entire wardrobe was from 1991. So we wrote those jokes, and then he got up and did that character. And I got up and did the character that just did one-liners and took, like, enormous breaks between the one-liners, drank, like, half a beer between the one-liners, like, didn't do anything when I got up. I just got up and looked at people for a while and adjusted the mic. And
so that's your act now.
It's similar, yeah. I mean, it's morphed and evolved.
Yeah.
But I really liked doing that. Like, I really liked getting up on stage, which I still do to this day. I like getting up on stage and, like, taking a second and just, like, letting people murmur or letting whatever happen happens and adjust the mic and look around and do whatever. Like, I mean, people love getting up on stage and going, like, hey, how's everybody doing tonight? All right, what's up, ladies? You know, like, it's just people do that. And I have nothing against that. I don't care, but I have zero interest in ever doing that. The fact that in a given night, if you go to an open mic night, there's 20 comics, I guarantee you 15 of them will get on stage and start by going, how's everybody doing tonight?
Yeah.
So, like, one, we already know how everyone's doing tonight. No one cares anymore. And a lot of people do it as just a comfort. You know, it's just comfort.
It's a quick way to easily get a positive response.
But see, it sucks when you don't.
How's everybody doing?
So if you're the 15th person to do it, yeah, people are going to be like, shut up. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, when I started, I went to open mics and stuff, and that was a thing that I quickly learned was just, I don't care how everyone's doing. Like, it just doesn't bother. Like that was from being on stage and for, you know, a decade before that, or 15 years before that, doing theater and everything. Was like, I literally don't care how you're doing. I know how I'm doing. And we'll see if you can do what I'm doing, you know, like, if we're on the same page. And if we're not, we're going to have a bad night. But if we
would
are...
Would you... I mean, you would have a bad night, too? I mean, do you just enjoy doing what you're doing and whatever...
I hate doing stand-up.
You hate doing...
Absolutely hate it. Oh, that's not a joke. I hate it.
But
I need it.
What is the need? What are you getting out of it?
Well, don't tell my wife. Blowjobs.
By dumpsters. Dumpster blowjobs.
Mainly from Robert Larivere. But, like, we have a deal.
That's cheaper than paying you. So.
I won't get into that. I don't know. I can ask you the same question, or you the same question. What do we get out of it? I think if you could, is quantify the right word? If you can quantify what we actually got out of it, then maybe we could just find it somewhere else and not kill ourselves every night.
Well, I look at it, I enjoy entertaining. I enjoy being...
Stupid.
I enjoy, and I think I've said this before, where, like, even bring 10 people to my house and let me cook and put on a playlist and, like,
I'd rather do that. I'd rather do that.
I love that. Yeah, I love mm-hmm. entertaining, mm-hmm. whether it's at my house for, you know, dinner or... Mm-hmm. On stage, I feel like this is just a party that I'm kind of your host for these 8 minutes, if I, you know, mm-hmm. whatever, and I'm hoping we're all having a good time.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, I enjoy that feeling of, like, I made your night a little bit better. Hopefully.
Sure. I enjoy, I mean, here's the thing, here's why I hate doing stand-up, the easiest way to make it make sense. At first, it was just really fun. I had fun, because I felt like, I didn't do stand-up, I took over the open mic at the Blarney Stone. So I was hosting open mic, but I was not doing stand-up. So I would just get up there and just, you know.
And that was a harsh open mic, if I remember. I think I've talked to Nick Crosby about that, and he said it was like 3 hours or 2 hours of this
it's a legendary night of stand-up that I don't know if it would ever... I think if it started again, I don't know if it would live up to whatever people have made it.
Yeah.
But we had some really terrible nights. There were people, I can remember off the top of my head, one, Dave Callens. People would come over and over again every Sunday, and then Dave finally had a good set, and he never came back. And I was like, why haven't you come back? He's like, I had my good set. I'm never going back. And it made sense, because people would never have good sets there. And it was a bar. It wasn't, they had a stage, but they're used to, like, you know, dudes playing guitar and singing Irish songs. The Irish bar, I mean, the people who owned it from Ireland, the people who hung out there were from Ireland. It was a very local-centric.
So comedy was happening to these people. Yes. They were not there for comedy.
Yeah, nobody showed up for the open mic unless people brought them,
yeah,
which people started to kind of clue in and do. And then once they stopped, that's when they stopped making money. And they paid me an enormous amount to run that open mic. I mean, probably not as enormous as people are thinking, but way more money than I think most people get paid. And free drinks all night. So because they kept coming to me and saying, you know, would you do the open mic? And they had just fired Allison. And Allison's a good friend of mine, and so I kept saying, no, I'm not going to do it. Like, no, I'm not going to do it. Like, Allison's my friend. You fired her. I don't know why you fired her. It's none of my business. And then they came back with this figure, and I'm like, yeah, all right, I'll do it. I told Allison that. She's like, fine with me. I get it. Like, you know, so it was just a bar that people hung out at. But if you – here's the thing about Barney. The bad nights – were awful. I mean, fights. Zoltan decked a guy there once.
What does it take to get
a guy on stage.
What does it take to get Zoltan to punch a guy in the face?
I forget what exactly happened, but it was some guy who was trying to get into comedy. I remember that. And he would not stop talking to Zoltan at the table while people were on stage.
I remember
Zoltan turned to him and just said, you're never going to be good at this because you won't shut the fuck up. And then he like got up and walked outside. And then the guy walked outside and tried to get in Zoltan's face. I think the door guy jumped between them, or somebody jumped between them. The guy kept trying to swing at Zoltan, and so Zoltan just like decked the guy. And then, if I remember correctly, there were several fights that happened. So I might be remembering
anything
it wrong.
Like that anymore.
So full contact comedy.
But it was fun because it was like the bad nights were bad, and they taught you what you could get away with. And then the good nights were unbelievably fun.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievably fun because it was a place where you were never going to get discovered, and, you know, nobody was going to come down there and be like, oh, I like this kid. Let's put him on the TV. Like, it was never going to happen, and every comic knew that. So it was like, here's a place where you can get up and you can try whatever you want to try. You can do whatever you want to do.
In a Tilt2-ish fashion? Kind of like
it's very Tilt2 is probably the closest thing we have since. Or Bar 11 was really close to it as well, when Nick used to run Bar 11.
That was it, Bar 11.
Yeah, just like, until 2 is kind of like that now. I love going until 2 because I feel that way when I go there. I was like, I can just get up here and try something and have fun.
So what took you from, like, I'm loving doing this and having these great nights and these horrible nights at the Blarney Stone to I hate doing stand-up
comedy?
Well,
I started doing stand-up because Rajon Darney and Christian Spicer came to the open mic and they said, you should start doing stand-up.
Because you were just hosting.
I was just hosting. So I just get up and I talk. I gave people the worst intros ever. I still do. People want me to host things are in for a horrible evening because I do not care about giving you a good intro. Yeah. It's not interesting to me. Hey, this guy just got back from Vegas. Like, blech, hate it. And so
that's that punk in you. That's that, like, I don't need your intro. I didn't want a good intro. Don't tell him how great I am because I'm gonna go be whatever.
But I mean, like, I don't know. If you have real credits, I could see you having an intro. Like a real intro, but if you don't, like people who go, oh, this guy's from Yo Gabba Gabba, I hate that, because I'm not doing anything that's Yo Gabba Gabba-esque,
right.
You know, like, no, like, I remember a show that they introduced me as that, and some lady in the front row got so excited that I was from Yo Gabba Gabba,
yeah.
And I was like, you are going to hate this, like, this is not what you want it to be.
Yeah.
So, I think if you have credits, sure, but if you don't, then who cares? Like, have fun. Like, we used to make up fake comedy clubs all the time and the worst things ever. And just, like, yeah, we'd bring up people to that. But then when I started doing stand-up at the Barney, it was great. It was fun. When I started going out and doing mics, it was great. It was fun. And it was a lot of punk in me where it was, like, I want to get up there and just kind of, like, do what I want to do. And even if it doesn't make sense and if it isn't funny, I just want to have fun. Like, the only person I'm interested in making laugh when I started stand-up was me.
Is it still that way? I mean, do you still kind of
Thanks, jerk. Oh, so it's still that way? You're the only guy?
No, but I mean, you you enjoy, is that the part you enjoy, Liz, having your own fun?
The part I enjoy the most is having my own fun. The part I enjoy the most is, like, you entertaining. I love making people laugh. I love sitting around with comics and, like, just bullshitting and just having a good time. Like, we don't, a lot of people don't do that anymore. I mean, maybe they do, but I'm maybe too old. Like, because my class is, most of them are in LA now, the guys I came up with.
Yeah.
So I don't really have a class. I'm kind of stuck in Vista without my guys. And that's not an insult to you guys at all. It's just like, you guys have your guys, you know, mm-hmm. like you came up with Ryan Hicks and those dudes and Zafra, you're, you know, Jimmy Wolpert. That's about it. that's good. But you know, you guys have like your dudes you came up with, and that's the dudes you kind of roam with. And, you know, Sam Wiles is as close, but he moved. Nick Crosby's kind of still my guy, but you know, so we used to all go out and hang out, and I love doing that. I love just sitting around drinking and having fun with those dudes. But I hate, like, sitting around talking comedy with comics. I mean, this is different, but, you know, if we're like, hey, let's all go hang out and get food. Like, I just want to hang out and get food. I don't want to hang out and be like, oh, man, my show last night. You guys, I tried this joke. Or did you see Jim Gaffigan's new special? Like, just shoot me in the face. Like, none of that is fun. So I hate that part of it. But the thing I hate most is the minute I get off stage. So that's when I start to hate stand-up. Had a great time. If I had a great show, the crowd laughed, super fun. And then the second I get off stage, I hate everything about what I just did. Like, literally, I hate it. I get broody. I get depressed. I don't care if I just...
Because you look at it and go, like, that wasn't... I caved. I didn't stick to my guns. Wasn't punk enough for my insides.
No. I think you're latching onto this punk thing. I mean, I love it, and I love like being anti-establishment, anti-authority. I mean, that's why I prefer to do bar shows. I prefer that. I prefer to cause waves and make problems in the crowd. I love digging a hole so deep I don't know if I'll get out of it. Mm-hmm. Like, and if I don't, it's even funner.
Yeah.
Like, for me.
Until you step off stage and a minute later you're like, what did I just do?
So what makes you want to get back
up? When I dig a hole and can't get out of it, that actually probably the only time I get real happy when I get off stage.
So you enjoy...
Failing.
Failing.
Yeah.
And then when you do well, you get off and you're like, that was hack? That was...
No. I don't... I can pinpoint... Oh, I could have done this better. I could have done that better. I could have made... If I'm riffing with the crowd or doing crowd work, I was like, oh, I could have hit that. I could have hit that. Like, immediately, that's what goes through my head. And so I'm one of those guys that'll come around. And it's not like I need validation. I don't need you to tell me I had a good set. But, like, it helps that if I can see somebody like, hey, good set. Like, and I can be like, okay, all right, well, I'll feel better for, like, 10 minutes. And then when I get home, I mean, just ask my wife. She hates when I do stand-up. Because when I come home, she's just like, she tries to fake like she's asleep so she doesn't hear me. Like,
oh, my God.
Honey, it was so bad. And then she'll, like, you know, see somebody and they'll be like, you killed last night. And she's like, why did you say it was bad? And I'll be like, because it was. It was stupid. I did this and I did that. And, you know. Like, I had a legendary set at, legendary for me, sorry. Should preface that. I had my own legendary set at New Best Thing. They had me headline. And afterwards, I quit for, like, 2 months. Like, I canceled all my shows because I was so mad with what I did on stage. But people were like, that was the funniest thing you've ever done. And I was like, hated it. Hated everything about it. So I quit for, like, 2 months. I just couldn't get over it. Like, it was too many things that I did wrong. And I don't like doing crowd. Like, the thing I do a lot that is I never want to be mean to somebody in the crowd just because I got mad. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like, if somebody's brooding in the front, like my child will probably do if she ever sees me do stand-up. If somebody's brooding in the front and, like, having a bad time, I like to try to, like, reference them and get them into the show. But once they don't and they kind of become jerks, then, like, I go after them and now it's just me being mean.
Because which in the moment you're like, this is happening, and then afterwards you're like, I'm an asshole.
Well, see, here's the thing that I'm going to sound a little egotistical, and I apologize, but I'm really good at crowd work, and so I know that I can get away with ripping into that person and get laughs. I know that I can accomplish that.
Not from that person.
Oh, not from that person. But at this Whistle Stop show, the girl that was sitting next to this guy that was really, like, I asked him, I was like, hey, man, you're not having a good time, and he's like, no, you're not funny. And I was like, okay, and so in my mind, it just clicked, and I'm like, I'm going to ruin your night. And I just ripped into him. The crowd was laughing, And at the end of the night, his girlfriend literally left in a cab without him.
Oh, my God.
And I'm like, I don't want that to happen. Like, why? You know, it's not like I...
You might have saved her life. I mean, she could be pregnant and miserable right now.
That's true. I didn't think about it like that.
Piece of shit.
Oh, man. So it's just stuff like that.
Dallas is a hero.
I feel like I was mean and did stupid stuff. And
so what makes you get back up then?
Because I need it. Because I need to feel like I'm doing something.
Yeah.
A lot of times I'll go do a show. I'll do by show I mean I'll go do a play or a musical or something, or I'll go write something for a musical. Just to feel like normal a little bit, if that makes any sense. Like I like to do essays. I do essays a lot for So Say We All for their Vamp Night. It's something I can.
Just like to feel like you're busy.
Not busy. It's more like. When you can sit down and, like, work on something and, like, be able to edit it and be able to, like, work on it and rewrite it and do a bunch of stuff, then I feel like I have a lot more confidence when I get on stage. Here's where I'm really not in shape. There we go.
Just to recap,
knees, guys.
He stood up with no arms holding a baby and the microphone.
Bad knees. But, yeah, so it's like, if that makes any sense, like, I'll go try to do something that's on the stage that I can be in charge of script-wise. Because therefore I know what the end result's going to be. I can judge what's going to happen. You know what I mean? Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Like if you go see the Godfather, not like anything I've written is that good, but if you go see the Godfather, you know people are going to enjoy that movie. There's no ifs, ands, or buts. There's no possibility of you ruining someone's night. There's no possibility of you bombing. Like, so if I can write something that I'm really confident in, then that makes me feel better. So I can go. So, like, I just did a show. I just wrote a children's musical, and we put it up, and that was really fun. And before that, I hosted a review show for a weekend. Like, that was really fun. Just stuff that I can be in control of that I know the end result will be positive.
Does that make any sense? Because you have the time to write it and then rewrite it and edit and think it through, and you, you're putting confidence on page.
Yes.
And that way you know, like, no, this is a finished product. It's not just this thing I had an idea about, went on stage, and kind of played with. It's like a confident, finished piece.
And it's in a script. So, like, people have to go by this. You know, there's not any
you're
room.
That kind of writer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, if you do a show that I wrote, you're doing what I wrote. But nominated for Emmys, guys. I mean,
yeah.
You're doing what I wrote. No, but I mean, like...
You're not watching the audience individually, like, who's enjoying it and who's not. You're just getting to...
I just sit in the back. If a joke I wrote hits, then I'm so happy. And if some stuff doesn't hit, it's fine because, like, I know that it's exposition or something like that. Like, there's just ways to feel way more positive about that kind of stuff than with stand-up. So every once in a while I take a break, at least a couple times a year I'll take a break and do something like that to kind of reset my head.
Yeah.
Because if I do too much stand-up, I get really mad. Oh, she likes that.
But do you want to do stand-up? Do you want to be a stand-up?
I don't know, man. When I grow up, yeah, right? I'm only 34 almost. I haven't picked what I want to do. Well, that's the tough part because you guys are stand-ups. It took me only recently that I really figure out.
Nope.
See, not gonna work. Only recently did I sit back and really like think to myself like, oh, I've made my living just performing, and writing and doing what I want to do since I graduated high school. Like, which is in itself, I think,
success.
I guess.
Yeah.
I haven't been able to only a few times during my life have I made enough money to be like, okay, well, I'll also go on vacation or, you know, I'll buy a ring for my soon-to-be wife or we'll have a wedding. Like, only a few times have I been able to make enough money where that's a thing.
Are you happy, though?
I'm sorry?
Are you happy?
Sometimes. I'm happy. Well, I'm happy with I love my wife. I love my daughter. Like, happy with all that. I love Netflix.
Do you have, some darkness in there, though?
Well, if you don't, then why are you in this industry? Am I wrong?
You're not human. I mean,
well, you're not human, but I mean, especially comedians. Like, comedians are artists. Like, why are we getting on stage? We're getting on stage to hide the sadness that's in our lives. I mean, it's on. If you meet a happy stand-up, then he's the worst stand-up you've ever met.
I would consider. See, I, that's
you do drugs,
that's
him. Though. You do drugs.
No.
I smoke marijuana.
Yeah, you do drugs.
What does that mean? What is that? You drink coffee? That's what's the difference. You're putting a chemical through your system that changes you.
Do you want to get into this?
Sure.
Can we edit this out? Come on, I'm just taglining it. But you've done more than marijuana. I don't know if you want to talk about it.
I tried mushrooms for the first time last weekend.
Oh, you did?
And that's it?
How was it?
That's it. That's all I've really ever done.
Because here's the thing with marijuana for me.
I've done a bump of coke twice in my life.
God, dude, see, cocaine's so weird to me.
No, I did.
But it's weird to me because it's like, it's almost like beer to me, alcohol to me, where it's like, I could see myself really enjoying it.
I said that recently.
I didn't get any, I don't know.
Oh, you didn't get anything out of it?
I got nothing. I remember one time, we talked faster. There were three of us there, we just talked faster.
See, to you, that's all that happened, but to everybody else, they're like, James was crazy. I think he killed the guy.
We're just talking. The conversation got quick.
I've never been into drugs at all, except for beer, but I just always thought they would make me dizzy.
That's a drug.
It's a legal drug.
That's well, okay. Somebody took a sheet of paper and wrote on one side, these are chemicals that we're going to say are okay, and then these are chemicals that aren't. So there's drugs.
Some of us break the law, some of us don't, James.
This is California. It's legal.
Yeah, legal in quotes. I get why people do it. I'm just saying, how long have you been doing stand up for?
Ago was 2 years.
2 years. Yeah, I've been doing it a little over 4 years now. Zaffer, what are you at, 2 years?
Not quite yet.
Okay. So I think you get to a point where you enjoy it. For the first few years, or 2 years or a year and a half, I really enjoyed doing stand-up. It was very fun, and it was also when I was, like, single and just went out every night and just did, well, not every night, because back then there wasn't as many open mics as there are now, but we just had fun and we would just get crazy and... When you have to start looking at some point, you have to start taking it seriously. And I think that if you want to do it, and I think there's a lot of comics that don't understand that side of it.
What do you mean by taking it seriously? What does that mean?
Good example. Here's a great example. Is this last weekend, for me anyway, for this last weekend, I did the Ron Funches thing at American Comic Con, mm-hmm. and I featured, and you are being such a stinker. Why are you mad that I'm not paying attention to you? I'm talking to my daughter. What are you doing? And you guys have seen me recently. You guys have seen me do stand-up, and I tend to drink a lot before I go on stage or while I'm on stage or whatever. And this weekend, I really wanted to be like, okay, what if I don't? And it was something that I'd never done before.
So you went up completely sober, no drinks.
I had Jameson on the rocks. I got one before I went on. I got one like 10 minutes before I went up. Mm-hmm. So I only had a couple sips, went on stage with it. Because it's for me, it's more of a timing thing.
Yeah.
It's a prop. And I think so. I had one for each show. So I was sober because that does nothing to me. But it was more that it was a prop, but I felt better about everything. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. I felt
more sharp.
I felt sharper. I felt like I was able to enjoy everything about what was happening. Mm-hmm. Whereas I feel like if I drink, when I drink too much, which happens, and I get on stage, like I enjoy what's happening. And then like I get off stage and I'm like, where's the next drink? This is dumb. Let's go somewhere else. So I feel like I'm trying to get more serious about it because I feel like when you want to start making money doing this and when you want to start getting paid and trying to go on the road and do stuff, I just think that's what I mean by getting serious about it. Like,
you can't be drunk for every show.
You can't be drunk for every show. Because then also you get a reputation, and I think you get. I don't think you get as good. There's a lot of comics, so many comics, that will always tell you they got way better when they got sober. And I'm not saying that I'm getting sober. I don't have a drinking problem because I don't
admit it.
Don't admit it. And I'm, like I said, I'm Catholic, so that's not a drinking problem. It's a religion.
Yeah.
And we just deal with this.
Now, for you say, like I don't drink before I perform. I don't smoke.
Good.
I am completely sober on stage. Yeah. Unless I purposely am like, hey, it's a Till 2 show, and we're celebrating some crazy thing, and I'm going to get completely hammered take my shirt off. Because that's what this night's about.
Yeah, yeah. If it's one of those shows where you're just hanging out and doing whatever you want to do, who cares what you do?
Right.
I think that's part. You need those nights in comedy. you like if you don't, then if you don't, then you're Zoltan. You know what I mean? Like you, you only headline and then take off, jerk.
Be a part of the community, Zoltan. Yeah, but
come on, Zoltan, hang out one time.
Well, let's back up to the part where you said sure. that as a comic, you're doing this to like hide the darkness.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I have darkness in me, and it's surprising to people when it does come out.
He's but the
I
exception to the rule for the most part, though.
Like, I don't agree with the philosophy that, like, unless you're dark and miserable on the inside, you're not a good comedian unless you have that.
Oh.
Because
he's the exception, really. He's a very positive person. He's the only person like him comedy. That I know.
How bad can this shit be?
Oh, just you're only, what, 2 years? 2 years?
But still, even like you said, you've been paying since high school.
Mm-hmm.
You've been paying for it off some type of creative outlet of writing or okay, music or comedy or whatever.
Here's what it is. And I, listeners, you were, I feel like I was rambling with that. Starting to be responsible
thing. We'll edit it
thing.
Out. It's fine.
don't. No, don't. Because I think I was making a good point where I'm trying to become more responsible. What I was trying to say is I want to take this more seriously, like I would if I did a stage production.
Right.
I want to start doing my stand up like that. I feel like I'm just starting to hone in on my voice, mm-hmm. blending one lines in with stories.
How many years
characters.
In? How many years in of stand-up?
Just over four. So I feel like I'm really getting there. I feel like I've been getting a lot of great opportunities in L.A. to do shows, and that's really helping me. Like, because you get really nervous, although it's so stupid to get nervous.
Do you still get really nervous?
Every single time.
What's really nervous for you?
I get butterflies. I get, depending on what I'm doing, when I featured for Fitzsimmons, my first feature ever for a real headliner was Jin Kirkman, and I was like... could not control
the nerves.
Like it was really
drink?
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Do you find that the show like that you were drinking more? Like were you
No, not more than normal.
So you were just intoxicated. You weren't overly intoxicated.
But I mean she was too, so it worked out. But I mean like the first show I did, I was so nervous, and then I got up and like I did and you know, again not to sound egotistical, but I did very, very well and I was really excited. And from that point on, it's been a little bit easier, but I still get nerves. Like Fitzsimmons, he was one of the first stand-ups I ever saw live. So to actually be able to share the stage with him and feature for him was such an honor, and he was so nice. So it was really weird. So you just get nervous because it's like these are your heroes. If you've grown up – like I grew up watching and loving comedy. Mm-hmm. So I'm a comedy nerd before I was a – you know, before I started doing stand-up and – when you get to meet some of these guys, it's really nerve-wracking. So, yeah. I mean, but that's starting, I feel like that's starting to subside a little bit, where I'm now just getting more nervous about my performance than nervous whoever is
less
in the room.
Less starstruck-y?
Yeah, yeah. Like, the first time I ever did a show in L.A., it was a surprise, but Maria Bamford was the headliner.
Wow.
And she is my top five. I saw her do a show at Comedy Death Ray, and, oh, my God, like, I just could not stop laughing. I saw her on Comedy Central when I was really young, and I couldn't stop laughing. She's amazing. And so I got up on stage, and I had the – there's a stool, you know, and I had my beer. And I set down my beer, but I was so nervous that I accidentally hit my beer on the stool, and it spilled everywhere on the stage and on the stool. And it was so embarrassing. And so I picked up the beer, and I was – and, you know, maybe not to the crowd it was so embarrassing, but to me it was like – you're an idiot. And then Matt Champagne, who's a great comic in LA, he came up after me and put his recorder on the stool into the beer puddle. And he was like, motherfucker. And I was just like, oh, you're an idiot. And then after the end of the show, Maria Bamford came up to me and she was like, hey, you had a great set. You were really good up there. And I was like, yeah. You know, I literally was like, cool.
In my mind, she walks away and you just see this ring of, like, she sat on the stool and her ass is wet. She doesn't even know.
Oh, dude, she was so good. But then she came to American Comedy Co. Maybe 6 months later and remembered me, which was, like, a highlight. But anyway, we don't need to get into that. But so I feel like...
hold on, let's get... No, I want to get into that because that's real. Because it's interesting that, like
you
said,
you get
nerves.
We can talk about it. We'll go back to the darkness whenever you want.
You get nerves as a comic before you up, or any type of performer, I'm sure. When you were doing music, I'm sure you still before a show would get a little just jittery.
Anytime I'm about to go on stage, right. Yeah.
And then also doing that where you would, you know, she remember you 6 months later, that means something.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, you know, she's not remembering because of your good looks and your face and your sweet, bald, shiny head. She's remembering the fact that you were hilarious.
Yeah, I don't know if I was hilarious, but she remembered that I thought I had a good set. I think there's a difference between good set and hilarious. You were unstoppable.
And I then didn't want to go up after you.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's good. Like, first time Paulo Gatta saw him, I talked to Paulo Gatta. We did a show together, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, I don't even want to go up now. And, like, that was like, what the hell? Like, that dude, that's so sweet of you to say. And but, I mean, you know, that's like, you were great. Good set is, hey, I got a few laughs there, guy. I can see some potential in that.
Keep going another 8-10 years. Yeah, see what happens. Yeah,
you'll get there.
But as a human, I mean, it's weird that, in a way, I think as comics especially, you know, we get opportunities down here, which are kind of nice because we're so close to L.A.
Sure.
That people come down, and like you said, you got to do that weekend Funches this past weekend. Yep. And where, you know, if you were a guy doing this in Austin, mm-hmm. Texas, you're not going to have the opportunities that we get at some of the clubs here, just of the names, probably.
Maybe. Well, Austin might be a bad example at this point. Yeah. Austin's getting bigger and bigger.
Like, really good competition.
But you're not getting just guys coming down for a weekend.
If you're in Boise, you're not getting these opportunities.
So
at all.
So I think it's very human to be a little struck, and actually it's probably good for all of us to have those small opportunities here and there to, like, be on a big show and kind of get over it.
Well, I think that the moment, I mean, and here's, this kind of ties hand in hand to the darkness thing, which I'll explain to you. Is she getting upset? Did you just have the spit rack? Just ready to go. She's getting tired, and she wants more food. Bedtime is an hour away, and she's getting all mad.
David's doing well, though.
Well, he's got two babies.
Better with your child than...
You son of a bitch. I told you, she literally, this is the thing about kids out there. For my kid, anyway, she literally will be the greatest with everybody. And then when she gets mom and dad, she's like, I'll get away with everything. I think it's just like smell. Like, she's like, I know this guy.
This is safe.
I'm around this guy all the time. I can be who I want to be. Mm-hmm. And whoever that is just a stinky little stink face. But she's adorable, and I can't help it.
Very adorable, baby.
Thank you. But I did a weekend with Brian Posehn. And like I said, one of the things that tipped the scales for me to go into sketch was Mr. Show, which he was a part of. So when I first met him, I didn't want to geek out on him. And I've met a lot of famous people over the years, because when we were doing sketch, we were at Comedy Death Ray. So we actually were doing shows with Louis C.K. before he broke big. And, but if you're a comedy nerd, you knew him for years. We would do shows with Swartzen and Patton Oswalt. I mean, Comedy Death Ray back in the day, before it was Comedy Bang Bang and moved to UCB. It was at this place called the M Bar, and it was utterly amazing. You would pay $5 to get in, and it would be the best comics. In one night, you would see Sarah Silverman, Patton Oswalt, Dana Gould, Chip Pope would be the host, or Jimmy Pardo, who's my favorite stand-up, would be the host. Just the greatest lineups. And you paid $5, and sometimes it wouldn't even be full. You know, I mean, you'd have, Anthony Jeselnik opened for... why can't I remember his name? David Cross, open for David Cross, you know, and it's like half full because it's LA, no one cares. But you're up, we drove up from San Diego all the time. Like, so we became friends with Scott Aukerman, who wrote for Mr. Show. So, like, that was an enormous thing. And he would book us on that show. But it was different now that it was like I was in Posehn's element. Like, he's a stand up. So now I'm meeting him as a stand up. And I walked in the room and I was just like, I don't know what to say to this guy because he's such a legend in my mind. And he started talking about a Mr. Show sketch he wrote. And he was actually on Yo Gabba Gabba. Mm-hmm. And then I saw Yo Gabba Gabba live in L.A., and he was the dancey dance guest. So he would come out and do this dance, and it was the stupidest thing ever. And so I brought that up to him. And we started talking.
You're like, by the way, I'm an Emmy-nominated writer for Yo Gabba Gabba.
At the time, we had already won an Emmy. but no, I told him I was involved, and he was like, oh, cool. And then we started talking, Mr. Show sketches. And that happened organically, and like me, I'm just like exploding in my pants because I'm like, he's talking about Mr. Show sketches, like, you know, like, it was crazy. And then I was trying to explain, but then when we went and hung out, because he's like, hey, let's grab a beer. When I hung out, like, I just zipped up because it was like, oh, I'm on the streets with Posehn. And of course, he's super recognizable, so everyone was taking photos with him downtown. And I just, like, clammed up. I didn't know what to do. And we got out, and we're hanging out as people, like equals.
Just the two of you?
His teacher came with us.
Okay.
Who's a very funny guy, Jeremy Essek. And And my buddy Joe Chandler, who was in our sketch group, who now writes for American Dad, we hung out like maybe a week later, and I was telling him and stuff, and I was like, but I was so nervous. And he's like, dude, you have to remember, like, you're those guys equal now. Like, you are those guys. Like, you were talking about the Aquabat Super Show, because I talked about Aquabats, and he's like, oh, I'd love to be a guest on the show. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, he says that because they also want to keep working.
Right.
He's like, you are not, like, they are not better than you. They don't see themselves as better than you. They probably see themselves as more experienced, maybe a better comic. But you're equals. Like,
if you just act like a human, they're going to be totally fine with you being a human.
And once I, like, let that sink in, like, so with, like, Kirkman came after that and Fitzsimmons came out after that, like, I can, like, now, like, it's pretty easy to sit with these guys and just kind of bullshit a little bit, you know?
Because I would think, actually, you know, because I've been in this scenario where you kind of do just sit there and, like, I have nothing to add to this conversation. Yeah. I can't believe I'm sitting here.
Yep, yep.
And let's face it, at the end of the night, they're probably sitting there being like, that was so weird. That guy sat there all night and didn't say a word.
Yeah, yeah.
You're like, you actually came off weirder.
Yeah.
By not
speaking.
Like,
they get on their phone and they're just on their phone, you know, and you're like, oh, what a dick. He's on his phone. But it's probably because I'm just sitting here in the room.
Staring at him.
Yeah, dude, it's so weird. Like, Funches was really nice this week and super nice guy, but I didn't have a lot that I think just naturally came out and talked to him. You know, sometimes it happens where I just still don't feel anything with the person, you know?
Said, yeah, they're humans. It's no different than meeting somebody at a supermarket. You either somehow have a reason to speak to each other or don't, even though you're both comedians. It doesn't mean that it's just going to be great conversation.
Yeah, it doesn't mean we're going to, like, you know, be like, oh, we should start a comedy duo together. This is the greatest night of my life.
Yeah.
But see, that's where the darkness comes in for me. When I started to realize that we're all equal, because I've spent a lot of time, you know, we had a sketch, like our sketch group, we did a showcase for Comedy Central back in 2004, and that didn't pan out. And that was kind of the first step in me really understanding that Hollywood, LA, that this entertainment business we've chosen sucks a lot. There's great little nuggets of wonder. But there's a lot of rejection. There's a lot of, you know, working in, like, even little things like Party in My Tummy. You know, like, that thing's a huge hit. And I'd love...
Somebody's made lots of money off that.
Mr. Nickelodeon has made lots of money on that. And I've been able to do a bunch of stuff, and I've been able to work on shows and get this opportunity. And I did a pilot. I was working on a pilot for Disney Animation for the last few years. And we had auditions for the voices, and they brought in, like, a stable of people for 3 days, like Mark Hamill, Brian Doyle Murray, like, all these amazing, amazing performers, a lot of comedians, and it was just, like, one after the other, like, you're just like, holy crap, this is wonderful, and then you realize they're reading words that I've written because they're also just trying to work.
Right.
And
they're also not going to get the part.
And they're not going to get it. Yeah, we are not going to hire Luke Skywalker. Like, we're not going to do it.
But damn it, he wants it. But oh my God, does he want that part?
He just wants more money. And, like, so it's see, that's where, like, I feel like the darkness starts to creep in. Is that, you know, you do start doing comedy or you start doing theater, whatever it is, in entertainment. I honestly feel this way. There's always that sense in the back of your head is, when is this all going to end? Because it probably is. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, you might just, you know, it might be when you're 55. It might be when you're 23. It might be whenever. But at some point, things are just going to dry up because that's the way it goes. That's the way this industry works. Unless you're an uber legend.
Well, I still think that kind of depends. I think that depends on what your definition of success is. And I guess the question is, like, when you were growing up, what did success look like to you? In your mind, like, every kid grows up like, I wish I was rich because my family wasn't or something.
Yeah.
But what, you know, rich is different to many people. Rich is like having a house and a car because they grew up without that.
I don't want to be rich. I'd like to just be able to afford the basics.
Right. And so, like, to me, like, I worked in construction. I managed a small family construction company in Florida. Like, I had a house. I had a boat. I had an airplane. I had a nice little life. Not all to myself. Like, shared in it. Like, cheap versions of these.
I had an airplane.
I had a share in an airplane.
What the hell are you doing here?
Because I hated 9 hours a day of my life working at this office.
Sure.
And I realized, like, this is not – like, I have a beautiful little life.
Mm-hmm.
But like now, I look back at that. Now I have no money. I honestly can't afford where I live.
Sure.
And I've never been happier. And I'm like, if I could just live how I'm living now.
Yeah.
Based on comedy, I'm like, that's success. Like, what the hell else would I want? I'm doing the thing that's the most fun I've ever done in my entire life.
Sure.
So to me, that is success.
Yeah, and I mean, like, I totally hear what you're saying, 100%, because I would have agreed with you, my late 20s, actually, sorry, for me personally, as, like, I'm exploring everything about myself, were probably the funnest, just nonstop funnest years of my life. Now, were they the most productive years of my life? Not even a little bit. Were they like looking forward? You know, was I looking at the future saying, well, this will lead to something? Probably not at all. But I was really, really happy and enjoying myself. And around that time, like I said, is when I really started to look back and say, oh, wow, I've been able to do exactly what I want to do and live and be able to live. Now, a lot of those months have been super tight, where I had to lean on parents or lean on certain people to borrow money. Mm-hmm. Luckily, you know, my wife has a great job. And luckily, the past few years have been very kind to me as far as work. And, you know, we've been able to kind of create this little pocket for ourselves. And my version of success when I was a kid was two things, being the president of the United States or being on Saturday Night Live. Those were literally the two things.
So in your eyes, you're an utter failure.
I am. So that's the hard part. That's where I say there's like a lot of darkness, is because to me, I still am failing. I still am not reaching where I feel like I should be.
But meanwhile, you set those goals when you were 12.
Yeah. Probably even younger than that.
So okay, so let's say eight. At 8 years old.
At eight, I was a big fan of Phil Hartman.
Still well, yeah.
Dude, the glue. He was the glue.
But to set your goals there and still keep those goals that on the list as reasonable goals.
Zaffer, grab the mic.
Uh-oh, he's got
He's
some
carrying
knowledge.
My child, and it's great.
I just, I can sympathize. I understand, James, your point. But I get the Dallas is saying here in this specific situation. Like, I'm very happy. I have a great wife who's really, really supportive of my dreams. Mm-hmm. And I have two kids that make me happier than anything that's ever made me happy. And I'm doing comedy. And that's the thing that I want to do. But it's also so fucking hard to just...
You're holding my child. You just got the F-bomb. Holy cow. If her first word is the F-word, I'm going to punch you in the nuts. All
sorry,
right, go ahead.
Forget
going.
To censor myself.
It's okay. She doesn't know what you're saying.
I think the whole thing about not knowing, like, we don't have check marks, so you don't know if you're going down the right path, if you're doing something. It's just like putting all this energy into something, and even though you're happy while you're doing it, not knowing all the uncertainty that comes with being an entertainer, it's so hard. You know, like, yeah, maybe you'll kill at the American Comedy Company one night, but then still, you're not a stand-up comic, you're not Louis C.K., you're not doing all this stuff. Yes, I think we are maybe appreciative of how well we're doing in our lives and that we can be so fortunate to even have what we have now, but I don't think that makes it any less depressing when you're like, what am I doing? I'm going out on this show and I'm leaving my wife and kids at home, and like, is this going to pay off? Is this worth something in the end? Like, am I going to be looking back on this with some sort of regret? Because that's this kind of stuff that I'm going through right now. Like, do you have insecurities about that kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, to kind of tack on to the earlier point, when I met my wife and stuff and we got serious about being together, I've had numerous friends who are in the industry and friends that I've worked with for years that came up to me and came into my wife and gave her what I think is a wonderful compliment, is that, you know, since I met her, they noticed that I really started focusing. And I still think that's a huge compliment to her, because I was all over the place. Mm-hmm. I'll do this and I'll do that and I'll be in this and I'll be in that. I stopped playing music because really I have no future in music. I mean, it's fun to do.
You weren't actually playing music either.
I wasn't playing anything. In fact, I was in a band where I screamed and fake played the bass. Play the bass. Like,
you
I was
acted.
Just
you're an actor.
I carried a bass and it was never plugged in. Like, it was just, like, why was I doing that and wasting my night?
The crowd was like, that guy's got the nicest bass. It must be wireless.
It literally took people sometimes the whole set to figure out that I was never plugged in, which is, like, an achievement to me. But it's, like, that's never going to lead to anything. Like, it's just fun. But, like, but this night that I'm doing that, I could be home working on a script. I could be home doing something that's actually going to further me. And so when I met my wife and I got serious about, okay, I'm going to marry this woman, I'm going to need to start really focusing on, like, what I need to do, because these things aren't going to pay the bills. And I know that to some people, maybe they're like, oh, that sounds terrible. But as long as I can do it doing what I want to do, as long as I can sit down and write a script that has jokes that I love in it and sell it to somebody, like, that's a win to me. But that's not the finish line. And as Rob Riggle once said on WTF, never a more true thing has been said, is that there is no finish line for comics.
No.
There isn't. That's why Seinfeld still gets up and does sets.
Well,
Cosby just released the new special. Right. There's no finish line.
I forget. What, was it Seinfeld that said, like, or somebody said, like, Seinfeld wants to be Cosby, and Cosby, or some, you know, they're like, everyone looks to that next guy, like, you know, somebody wants to be Pryor, and somebody wants to be the Cosby. And, you know, it's like, there's always...
Well, and, like, you know, you're saying, like, you're not Louis C.K. yet, you're not doing this yet, and, like, that's the scary thing about our business, is that's, like, 1% of the comics are those guys. Well, I mean, you got your Pattons, you got your Bill Burr, Louis C.K.
Which you would kill for that career.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right.
So, and like, you know, and I told my wife, I'd kill for Fitzsimmons' career. That guy probably makes... Probably makes five grand a weekend. That's, if he's doing, you know, probably 35 weeks a year, that's great. That's a great living.
Right.
And, you know, and he's a funny stand-up, and he's respected. Like, that would be great. So, like, I feel like I'm very insecure. I'm very scared of what's happening. And with my wife, when, you know, one of the things I agreed to her is I worked really hard at stand-up. For as much as I dislike most of the time I'm doing it, I work really hard at it. And I feel like I've gotten, the last year and a half, I got to a point where I can kind of pick and choose what I want to do with shows. I'm usually asked to feature a headline. I say no to shows most of the time that I don't get paid at. You know, you get paid for most of the shows I do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a commitment that I made to her was, you know, I want to be here for her and the baby, and I should, if I'm not getting paid, I'm not going to drive 45 minutes
to go drink
10 minutes and pay $15 for drinks and then drive back and then, you know, be away from my family, where I could have just stayed here. She could have hung out with the baby and I could have worked on something new,
mm-hmm.
could have written something new or done something that was more productive. And not that, you know, and that's because I'm at that point. Because my biggest advice to all stand-ups is stage time. Like, that's the only thing that's going to make you better is being on stage. That's it. There's no other way that you're going
to
get better.
Do you feel that you have to, like, kill yourself with it? Like, if there's three mics on Sunday and there's two mics on Monday, like, you should be hitting every single...
Well,
or do you feel that there's a happy medium of, like, you have to be seeing the return on investment and just grinding it out, being...
Well, there's two... You know what? It's a weird... Because there's Russell Hicks, who's... One of my favorite, I mean, literally out of real stand-ups, like, not real, the real stand-up sounds such like an insult, but out of, like, people like Louis C.K. and stuff, like, mm-hmm. Russell Hicks is probably in my top 20. Like, I love that man to death. We started at the same time. I watched him grow from a comic who just yelled at the audience to a comic who is now in England and just blowing up, just doing crowd work, like, doing successful, awesome crowd work.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, sure. When he went to L.A., all he did, she likes to walk around too. Sorry. I can carry her if you want, man. You don't have to. It's just your podcast. But it's your podcast. Welcome to We Can Edit That Out with Dallas and James.
We're special guests here. You're the guest. We need you to be available to speak and not get too distracted.
I got
with
my
this
dumb
right
baby.
Now.
Russell. Like, Russell, when he went to L.A., all he did was mics. I mean, he would go do three mics a night. He'd start at 5:30 and end at 12:30. He'd do as many mics as he possibly could. And there's something to be said for that because people around town got to know him. But then he also figured out, like, I don't like being in L.A. I don't like doing this. I want to do something else. Guys in New York, that's what they'll do. They'll do 5 to 6 mics a night. And there's something to be said for the guys that hit the grind and try and try and try. For me, and I think dudes like Greg Santos, we found, I found it way more helpful to go, okay, let's do this show. We're doing this show. Now let's all go hang out. Like, hey, owner of the club or booker of the club, like, let's go hang out. Like, let's, oh, hey, Greg Fitzsimmons, let's go grab a beer. Well, he doesn't drink. Or, like, Henry Phillips came down one night, and there was another show, and after it was a show we did at ACC, and he was like, what are you doing now? And I'm like, I don't know. I don't know. I could go do another show. Do you want to go do another show? Because obviously he could walk in and get up. And he was like, nah, let's just go hang out, right? And I'm like, yeah, let's just go hang out. Like, we were in Vegas one time, and me and Santos, and we did this show in Vegas and with two other comics, and this was pretty early in my career, and they were stand-up career, and they were like, we did the show. The show was fun. It was really nice. And Greg's like, all right, let's go out. And the other comics were like, well, we're going to go do this, these two other mics, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, why would you do that? We just did a great show. Because in my mind, it's like, we did a great show. Now, what if the next show sucks? And then you're just going to be bummed that the last show you did sucked. When you just did a great show, now let's all go hang out and be buddies. Like, so now that when you come to San Diego, I'll remember you.
Right.
And I'll be like, hey, you're awesome. Like, come do this show. Or when I come to Vegas, you'll be like, hey, man, you were great. Let's come do my show. I was always more interested and still am more interested in building relationships with guys that I like or guys that are funny. I mean, in L.A., that's half – I mean, literally half the game in L.A. is – or probably New York – is just knowing people. It's just walking to a bar and knowing – if she falls asleep, it's fine.
Yeah,
she'll wake up in a minute.
They have to remember your face.
They have to remember you.
If they think of your face, that's how you're going to get on some show.
And like, and I tell this to stand-ups too, you know, is that you can grind and grind and grind and grind, and you can get your feet wherever you're at. Like, you can get your feet in San Diego, get your footing. That's the right phrase, not get your feet. You can get your footing in San Diego, wherever you are. But if you're serious about making it as a stand-up, really trying to make it as a stand-up, then it's not going to happen in San Diego. It's you can spend years here if you want, finding your voice. I mean, I've been here for 4.5 years, and I feel like I'm just starting to get to a point where I can confidently go somewhere else and confidently get on stage and know that I'm going to do well. Where I was, say, 1.5 years ago when I started doing shows in L.A., I was not confident, and I didn't do very good sets. And so that's where it's going to happen. But also, as a stand-up, you have to realize that, like I said, the chances of you making it as a stand-up, making this your job and your career, that it's so small. It's so small. So you have to be prepared to have other things. So that's why I started writing as a sketch writer, and that was the road I took first. But now I have a portfolio of writing that I can send out. You can be an actor. I mean, look at Andrew Santino, who's a fantastic stand-up, and the guy acts nonstop. Like, he's in shows nonstop. So there's that. I mean, that's the thing, is like, if you go to L.A., you go to New York or Chicago or wherever, the opportunities aren't just going to be in stand-up. Oh, I'm in L.A., so I mean, I can become a famous stand-up now, right? Wrong, because there's 3 times as many stand-ups in L.A.
Right.
than whatever city you're in. But you're like, I did a show in UCB one time, and I got a call 2 days later from the casting director of Community, and all they wanted was my resume and headshot on file, and they didn't want me to come be a stand-up on Community. If anything, they just wanted me to probably be some bit part. But it's like, that's the stuff that happens, and that's the way you can start making your living, is by writing, being little bit parts, being, you know, maybe getting cast full time. So when people want to go out and they want to just grind, to me, I'm like, you can grind all you want, and that's one way to do it. If all your interest is just, I only ever want to be a stand-up. Like Russell Hicks, I go back to him, he only wants to be a stand-up. He could care less about sitting down and being a great writer or getting a part or acting in a movie. I mean, he'd probably enjoy it, but he wouldn't care.
Right.
He just wants to be an awesome stand-up, and I respect that. But if you're interested in trying to make a career for yourself, if you go to L.A. or New York or something like that, you have to start focusing on the other things that stand-ups are hired for. I mean, Joe Wingert, such a good stand-up, and writes for like 3 shows right now. I mean, he has a great living, but you know, like, but he wouldn't if he was just like, I'm just going to be a stand-up. You know, he'd just be grinding it out like the rest of us. So, I mean, that's why, like, I'd rather if I'm at a night and I'm like, I'm going to do the show, and after the show I can go hang out at Bird's over by UCB and run into some people and have a couple of drinks, or, you know, and then I can go, oh, hey, remember me? Yeah. Oh, hey, we're doing this show Friday, man. Like, come do walk on and be the stupid part. Dude, I'm in. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. With all this work that you're putting into
not getting any returns, if that's the answer. Sorry.
No, God. This your entertainment, whatever it is, you're putting a lot of time and effort into it, obviously. How is that?
Whatever it is.
Yeah, whatever.
Whatever you do.
Well, because you're doing a lot of stuff.
I do a lot of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I mean.
It's okay. I'm not insulted. I'm not at all.
Okay. How does that affect, like, your personal life?
I don't really have one. I mean, you're married, you have kids. That kind of takes up everything else.
Pretty much.
And that's probably, you know, go back to an earlier point, it's probably why it is a good thing that I waited until I was in my 30s, because I kind of got everything out that I wanted to get out. You know, as far as, like, going out and hanging out with friends and being a kid. And now I just get tired earlier, and people bother me for the most part.
Yeah.
So it's good that I can come home, and I'm like, I enjoy coming home, and my wife and I have shows, Master Chef. We love Master Chef. Like, it's weird to, I mean, and you've been married too, so you know, you've been there, that literally you get excited about, dude, we can just eat some Oreos and we can watch Master Chef.
We're going to order Chinese and put pants on for the rest of the night.
The other night we got Thai food, and I was like, yeah, fuck yeah, we're getting Thai food. You want to watch Dallas Buyers Club? Yes, I do. Like, that stuff, like, really gets me, it makes me happy. And that wouldn't have been the case, you know, years ago. So I'm glad that I did wait until this time. But that, you know, obviously, because of that, like I said, I have really, really good friends that I grew up with, that I've worked with my entire career. Half of those dudes live in L.A. now, and they're working in L.A. consistently. And some of those guys have moved away to other places. One of my very good friends still lives in San Diego that... He's a brilliant writer, Nick McCann. I mean, really brilliant writer. But he is just, he wants to write books. Like, he's working on a novel, and that's his gig, you know. And so we're all kind of grown up. We all kind of don't really hang out much. Like, we have to really plan it out if we're going to hang out. And so, I don't really have personal life. Like,
yeah.
I love to read a book. It took me 2 years to read the last book that I read. Like, if that's an indication of free time. It wasn't a long book. Like, going to stand-up shows, it's more work now for me than anything. Like, I get paid, so I treat it like a job. And rarely, like, this weekend I was supposed to hang out with Sam twice after shows, but at both times it's like, not gonna happen, man. I gotta go to bed, you know. And he was like, yeah, I figured. But, you know, so it doesn't really happen as easy. I mean, you're getting up there. You're 32. Like, you're probably starting to feel a little bit where...
Well, I'm single. I mean, that's the thing, though. Like, I was single till recently, till I met a lady. But, like,
I
had no, you know, besides my job that's pretty flexible, too, it was more like, you know, if we're hanging out and it turns into 4 a.m., that's what happens, you know, after the mic or whatever.
Yeah.
A group of guys end up at Denny's and stuff like that. There was no...
Yeah, like, I can only get away with that every once in a while.
Right.
Like, if I'm like, well, we were hanging out, and it's like 3 a.m. and I just walk in, like, you know, I can only get away with
better
that.
Better be a big name.
Better be a big name. It's true. It's true, man. It's really true. Like, when I featured for Maryland Rice Cub, she was probably the most fun comic I've ever hung out with, because she loves the dance. And you might be weirded out by this, but I love dancing.
I'm with
like,
you.
I will go to clubs and I'm a good dancer. Like,
what,
I'm not
what type
lying.
Of dancing are we talking about?
Whatever you want, bro.
Oh.
I studied theater, so I can tap. I can do modern dance.
Nice.
Little hip hop, little jazz.
Little hip hop. I was in a hip hop band. I can dance. I can do some jazz. Little folklorico.
Okay.
But I love dancing, and so we hung out We hung out, and Matt Hall came and hung out. Like, everybody who was downtown at the time, we all just hung out. And she's cool with that because she's seen her on 24, my wife. She's in the other room. That's not true. She's not here. But she's probably out cheating on me. But she's seen her on TV, so it's fine.
Yeah.
You can hang out with her. You know what I mean? Like, And it was cool, but that's not, you know, every night that's not a thing. And every night I couldn't do it. Like, right. After that night, I got home at like 3, and I was just like, this is awful.
Like, tomorrow's fucked.
I'm going to die. Yeah.
You feel like you have a pretty good balance of everything right now, though?
Not at all.
No?
Well, I'm also struggling. Here's the other problem is, and I find this a lot in entertainers in general, is I'm an insomniac.
Okay.
I can't.
Wish I was.
You wish you were? Don't ever
sleeping.
Wish that.
I hate sleeping.
No, you love sleeping. Trust me. It's awful. Last night I was up till 2:30 in the morning, which doesn't sound probably late for insomniacs, but when I get up at 6:30, because the baby's up, like, it's not a lot of time. 6:30
comes quick.
And I wake up pretty much every 45 minutes when
I
go to sleep.
Do you keep busy while you're not sleeping, though?
I tried for a while. I have a blog. And for a while, I started the blog because I wanted to start writing when I would wake up. So I could just write random thoughts when I wake up, and then that would make me tired. The hope was. And it worked. And then, but then that worked for like a couple months, and then I went into a circle. So every like 2 months, I'll have about 2 to 3 weeks of insomnia, and then I'll be able to fix it somehow, do some trick. But it's terrible. So like, I mean, I don't have a good balance of things, but I don't know if I ever will, and I don't know if that's a problem. I don't think that's a problem. If everything was too structured, I think I would probably hate everything.
Yeah.
Like you had your job.
Yeah.
If you get too structured.
Oh, my God. Yeah. 9 hours a day. This is where you are. You're at a desk. You're dealing with this. The paperwork never goes away. These stacks are always, you know, it's just fucking miserable. There's
like,
no.
But you feel like you're kind of like, since you got so much stuff, you're doing comedy, you're writing, you have a wife and you have a daughter. Do you feel like, because so many things in your life, you're kind of like taking away energy from one thing that is lacking in something else, maybe?
Yeah, 100%. There's a lot of times where I, like right now I'm working on a one-man show. I know that sounds so cliche, but it's less of like a John Leguizamo one-man show and more of like a Mike Birbiglia kind of one-man show.
Oh,
and I've been working on it for like a year. And there are times when I'm like, well, I want to keep going and working on that, but something else will pop up that needs to be done quicker that's not nearly as important to me, but maybe it's like a small paycheck, so I'll do that first, and then I'll go back to the one-man show. So it's like, in the thing that I'm getting paid to write for, I don't put a lot of energy in because my heart's not in there, and I don't really care to work on it. But meanwhile, the thing I really want to work on is just sitting and sitting and sitting.
So you got a pretty solid back burner of things going on.
Oh,
like your
you
backlog
have no
of things
idea.
You want to do.
You have no idea. If I showed you my, where my scripts are, you'd probably
how many scripts
think
you
I was
have going
like Howard Hughes or something.
Is that what this box is for?
this treasure chest is full of great ideas. Every morning I just wake up and I put my hand in and pull out a little placard. I am in the middle of writing a play. I'm in the middle of writing the one-man show thing.
By the middle, do you mean like I've written half a page and a concept, or I've got a treatment, or you know?
The script, the play, I'm about halfway through, but that's halfway through first draft, so maybe I'm 15% done.
Mm-hmm.
I started writing a movie that will never be made, so I don't know why I'm writing it. But it's like one of the things that's in my head, so I just want to write it down. But that might never get done. And then I endlessly start sketches. So I probably have 30 to 35 sketches that are, you know, either have a first draft or a couple pages done that I probably will never finish.
But that's part of writing. I mean, that's where, I mean, you just do it and do it and do it, and the one thing you finish, or eventually you care enough to finish something, because, but I mean, I'm sure as along the way, the 30th one probably went together a little smoother or was better formed in your brain before it went down. I mean, that's part of the process, isn't it?
I don't know.
Just writing and writing and writing and writing. And
I feel like if you want to be a writer, like, you need to just write as much as you can. The same thing with comedy or anything, is if you want to do something, you just do it as much as you can. But for, like, a good example is I wrote a pilot with a buddy of mine, this guy Derek Acosta from Mega 64. We wrote this pilot that we really, really liked, and we've been meaning to – we were going to try to pitch it to some people. The people were kind of reluctant to meet with us. He had – you know, it was just like one of the things where he had an in with somebody, a producer, and then that guy got fired from the company, so, which happens all the time in L.A. It's ridiculous and cliche, but – So that ended. So then we were like, oh, well, we'll film it on our own. We'll just film it. And because I run a theater in El Cajon, and so he was like, you have this space. Let's just build some sets and film it here. I was like, yeah, perfect. And so we decided to do that in February, and it is June, and we haven't even started talking about it. Like, you know, so it's like I want to get that done because we both really believe in the idea and think it's really funny and could work, but I don't know when the hell we'll get to it. You know, like it's crazy. So it's weird. It's like I've put so many things in, I do so many things in my life that pay me money, and also I'm able to do like a little bit of entertainment or a little bit of performance or whatever in it, but it also detracts from like passion projects, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term. So it's hard. And I feel like stand-up gets in the way a lot of the times too, but but like I said, like now it's almost like work for me if I'm doing a show. I hope that doesn't sound bad. No, I don't like doing stand-up very much.
Unless it's for a paycheck. We get it. You're doing it for all the wrong reasons. That's fine.
Yeah. Wait till you start getting paid a lot. You'll do the same thing. Yeah. It's hard, man. It's hard. It's hard to keep it all balanced. My baby just grabbed the microphone from David and has yet to figure out what words are. She doesn't like Mexicans. I'm sorry.
Oh, look, it's okay.
Yeah, she's not a big fan. She's looking at you like you're a dinosaur.
Is that why she's been so cool? She's just terrified.
She's
terrified.
She's really scared.
Her defense mechanism is sleep. So she just, as soon as you grab her, she's like, sleep. And now she's scared.
Now she's just terrified.
Why is he so dark, Dad? You're not this dark.
Change gears a little bit here and do the other, stuff.
Did you have other questions?
Sorry. Oh, well, Christ these are, almighty. Yeah, this is all well and good, but I'd like to get into the heart of
I'm listening.
Dallas.
Don't be mad.
No, it's a quick one. Are
I'm
you afraid of death?
Three things at once. Sorry. I was listening. Am I afraid of death?
Yeah.
No. Not afraid of death. I believe I'm going to die at 57, and I still hold that belief.
Oh, does that kind of help you get through things then?
Get through things?
Well, like if you're not worried about dying, then
you know what's sad, like, is all I ever want to do is be a grandpa, literally, since I was like 15. Because my grandpa is literally the most wonderful man on the planet. I mean, hands down. And I've always just wanted to be a grandpa, and I'm deathly afraid I won't get that opportunity.
So that does.
I'm afraid of that. I'm afraid that I won't be able to enjoy my later years.
Yeah.
But I'm not afraid of death. It's going to happen. There's nothing I can do about it. We're all going to die. I'd like to live as long as I can.
Cool. Why aren't you afraid of death? Because I am. And
you
he's
are?
Not. So it's just gonna, this it's is the happen. Thing that's always like.
The only I'm afraid of is dying young. That's the only thing I'm afraid of. And only because, like, look, I have a baby. Yeah, I want to see her grow up. You know, you said this is a more personal podcast. A lot of people don't know this, but my mom was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer, 3 years ago. She was given 6 months to live, and she's still alive.
Nice.
How old?
Both our dads died of cancer.
God, that's
so.
A great freaking question. I don't pay attention to ages, as you've probably can tell so far. I'm not even sure I'm 33. That's the truth. I literally keep thinking I might be 34. She was probably 63 when she got diagnosed.
Okay.
And she got diagnosed. She has biliary duct cancer, which is basically pancreatic cancer, which is, you know, the most deadly of all cancers. Yeah. So she was given 6 months, and she's still alive to this day. And she went into remission for a while. And my mom is just that kind of lady. She's an old Irish lady. She's stubborn as all get out, and she's like, I'm not going to die. Like, literally the first day we went to the doctor. She was diagnosed. It was we went out. Her best friend was there. We got bagels, went home, and she just collapsed crying. And we both cried, and we both looked at each other and said, this is it. This is our day of crying. And then it's over.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure she's had since cried by herself.
Yeah.
But it was the only time we were allowed to be sad in public about it. And her biggest fear that she later told me was that she wouldn't – I wasn't married at the time – was that she wouldn't be able to see these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she's like, I've lived a full life, and I've had a great life. My biggest fear is that I won't be able. She used to make wedding cakes. That was one of her jobs. So she's like, I always wanted to make her wedding cake. She's like, my biggest fear is I won't be able to do that, and then I won't be able to see my grandkids. And it's one of the greatest things that I've been able to do is that I she's been alive. And luckily, I started dating my wife maybe 2 months before her diagnosis. And so, I mean, luckily it just played out like it did, that we could all, you know, do that. And I think for me, that's my biggest fear, is that, yeah, as well as not seeing my daughter grow up.
Definitely.
Which is why I'd like to take better care of myself. I don't, but I'd like to.
That's the first step, though.
I used to work out all the time, and I was not nearly as chubby as I am. But yeah, since having a baby, Zafra, you can attest.
It's more the comedy thing for me.
Wait till they get older.
Well, at least I can take her with me to places. You know, like now, if we go to the, like, you have a gym here in our complex. If I take her to the gym, she just gets pissed.
Yeah.
And so, like, at least if she's a little, she can walk or whatever, she can walk around the gym or whatever and do whatever.
No, but what I'm saying is right now you don't finish her baby food that she doesn't eat, but when they're six and you make them a plate of macaroni and cheese and chicken nuggets and they eat none of it.
Oh, and then you have
and you're
to,
standing there over a garbage can and you already ate dinner, but you're over a garbage can and you're like, no. And you
but
start eating
mac and cheese nuggets.
Because you're like, I paid for it.
Yeah.
I'm eating it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then 30 pounds later, you know.
Her formula looks good sometimes.
With a little vodka or something, maybe some rum, some spice.
Never know, dude. I thought about putting whiskey on her teeth before. Anyway. Yeah.
That's a good one, though.
Anyway, go ahead. What's your next question? Death. Done. Forget it.
Worst sexual experience? You want to talk about that?
I am a married man, Zach. So, no. I don't have a worst sexual experience.
Just been
I actually waited
straight
a long time
A's
to
all
have
the way?
Sex.
What's a long time?
I still haven't. That's not my baby. my wife and I are waiting for our divorce to have sex for the first time. No, I waited till I was 21.
Me too.
There you go. Yeah,
waited, or it just kind of never.
Oh no,
happened.
I had plenty of opportunities.
That you
plenty of chances.
That you completely.
Yeah,
is it
never
the Catholic
screwed
thing?
That up. Or
you know what?
Like,
I never felt
like
guilty. I always just wanted to be with somebody that was really special to me.
And then was it special?
It was. It was great. Oh, it was her first time, my first time.
And it's just been straight A's ever since.
Yeah, I've never had a bad experience. I mean, sex is great, unless you're really stupid.
Well, you never like feel like you maybe didn't perform to your fullest. Maybe
Yeah, there's plenty of times where you don't feel like that. You ever been? You ever drink alcohol?
You've had a bad set. I mean, you had a bad set during.
Yeah, man. If everybody's had bad sex, no one's always had great sex. But it's never to the point where you're like,
that was terrible.
I mean, I've never had that where I'm like, oh my god. I mean, I haven't had sex with many people. I mean, that's the truth there too. So I'm not a guy who sleeps around. That was never my interest. I've made out with a few people I would never have wanted to make out with. That's been things. I mean, I've had those experiences, but.
About best.
I love that you're just taking care of my child now. It's so funny. Best sexual experience with my wife.
Making that baby.
No, that was awful. Actually, that's the worst sexual experience. And she won't be mad if we talk about it. But we planned the baby. We wanted to have a baby. And she was on that. She had apps for when she was ovulating. She had all this. She peed on sticks. Like, everything was timed out, and it was literally
the next
like,
3 hours, the best. Like, we have to do this now.
She would wake me up at like 6 in the morning and be like, it's time to go. And I'm like, this is awful. No. and I'd be.
So, just because it was so mechanical and just like such a job.
It would just be like, well, the 6, the morning, the early morning, few times we did that. Well, we got pregnant right away. I mean, we literally.
Way to go.
Thank you. Well, we were told it'll take like 6 months. Nope, it took one weekend. and that was like the worst. It was just because I didn't want to. I wanted to sleep. You know, and there wasn't like any like, oh, yeah, we're having sex. It was more like, we are doing this for a purpose. So that was probably the worst. But I mean, the best was, you know, I mean, the first time my wife and I had sex, it was one of the moments where I'm like, yeah, all right. I could be into this for the rest of my life. You know, she's teeny and attractive.
Yeah. What would you say is your biggest insecurity?
I don't know. Anytime I get on stage?
Yeah.
To do anything? Yeah. Anytime I put something out there, that's my biggest insecurity.
You just want it to be good?
Want it to be good. Needs to be good. Dude, I will take my baby from you. Actually, I could go. Can we take a pause?
Sure.
Because I need to go pee pretty bad.
All right.
Man.
This has been an adventure.
Really, right?
Thanks for letting us.
Do you guys have any idea you were going to be here for this long?
That's why I said
we're prepared
like to leave
for a while.
Yeah, a couple hours just to see what happens. And
just
to see what happens.
Yeah, because that's, I mean, that's our goal, climb into your brain and see what we can pick out. And
you
see,
can't, like, you really want to know who Dallas is on the inside, you know?
Oh, yeah, right.
There's nothing there, man.
You get little glimpses of it.
Didn't make,
there we go.
Our couch is so deep. You get little glimpses of stuff sometimes, and it's tough to really open people up in a short amount of time, you know, and to get personal and stuff.
Well, if you're doing Taylor Tomlinson, of course. I mean, who is she, you know?
No, we got her wide open.
She's like 18 years old. There's no substance there.
Well, she her mom did die.
Yeah, all three
okay.
of us. All right,
sorry.
Died of
sorry about that. So.
Of cancer.
Really, her mom died?
All three of our parents died of cancer.
Oh, man. I'm sorry about
that,
guys.
She lost her mom.
Yeah. And
she's
had
funny,
a.
Man.
You told us the story about that person at the whistle stop and how you tore into them and felt really shitty about it. She had a similar story about a girl because I booked her on a show and some girl got topless on stage during Matt Burke's set.
Well, that'll happen.
Taylor Tomlinson she just totally just shit on her the whole time, and then she did really well. Everybody loved her. She's the only person that did well on that whole show. But she said she like cried all the way home. She was so upset.
Matt Burke did well enough to get a girl to take her top off, so she wasn't the only
That was his favorite moment in comedy. He was on Jeff's podcast, and he said that was
his favorite.
That was
moment?
His highlight in comedy. Number one, best show he ever did.
Taylor Tomlinson's funny, man. I almost don't like her because she's funny.
And she's 20. Like, that's she's so young.
She's only
going to
get worse, right?
Yeah.
She's only going to get worse.
So,
I mean, women aren't funny, though. That's the thing. Right, little? Yeah, see, even bringing up a woman comic, she's mad. All right.
Okay.
We
got
to go to bedtime soon, so.
That's fine.
For
so,
this little one.
This is going to come out sometime, and do you have anything to plug in 2016? Or?
Yeah, right? Jeez. Ew. Well, have you ever listened to this?
Do you have any words of encouragement for the fans out there?
Do you miss David? Is that the problem? Were you mad that I took you away from your friend? She is drowning in pounds. I know, you're probably hungry. We'll eat soon. All right, well, we got to just go.
All right.
This podcast has been fun. Thank you for having me, if it ever comes out.
Thank you very much.
Please
for
listen to my podcast. Everything's fine. It's on iTunes and Podomatic and Stitcher.
Cool, man.
And to all the other comics, stop being comics so I can have more shows.
Cool, thanks, man.
Thanks a lot.
Bye, guys.
All right, guys, that was the end of the episode. Thanks for listening, and hopefully you enjoyed everything. This is the last episode that I did with James Schrader. So, you know, there won't be any more of these unless I ask him to come back and do another one with me sometime soon. But yeah, Dallas is great. I hope you guys enjoyed that. Make sure to look him up on Facebook and check out his shows and all that stuff, guys. He's really great. So, yeah, thanks for listening. And I'm blessing you. I'm not the motherfucking bowhead. And if your wisdom is tell me both days. I'm in confusion, disturbing the peace. It's not an illusion, we run in the streets. So bye bye to all you groupies and gold diggers. Is there a bumper on your ass? No, nigga. I'm doing 100 on the highway. So if you do the speed limit, get the fuck out of my way. I'm DUI, hardly ever caught sober. And you about